I think I should have stretched a little bit, though, before I did some of those games. I'm a little sore. This morning, I have only a couple of things to say. One of them is that bad spammers bad. And those of you who have been spamming know who you are. We have a few fun conference facts to start off the day with. 33,000 cans of soda have been consumed. 25,000 bottles of beer. And we didn't even have beer at the breaks, so that's pretty amazing. 15,000 bags of chips. I guess there was only one chip in each bag. 10,000 granola bars. 16,000 bottles of juice. A lot of coffee. 10,000 bananas. 5,000 apples. More monkeys than... And 16,038 feet of net cable. This morning, we are happy to have Douglas Adams bringing us our keynote this morning. He's the author of Hitchhiker Guide to the Galaxy and the Dirk Gently series. We will be giving away one of the digital laptops at the end of Douglas's keynote this morning. And then Doug Henrich, Director of Developer Relations at Microsoft, will come out and he will talk about the developer program that we have and how you can stay up to date on all of the, when the SDKs are released and other things that we have going for development. And at the end of Doug Henrich's talk, we will also give away another laptop. So let's see. The only other thing is just to make sure that, I know I've said this several times, but just to make sure everybody knows, there are the two Java sessions today, one at 10 and one at 2 o'clock. And so anyway, with no further ado, I'd like to bring out Douglas Adams.
Hi, I hope that was the right time to come on. Actually, we couldn't hear the sound very well backstage, so I was just waiting for an awkward pause. I just wanted to get an idea about what Microsoft developers actually look like. And I also want to have a little bit of a wander around, in fact, because actually you can tell this is a Microsoft conference. Because there's a clock down here which is telling me to the second how many minutes I've got left of speeching, of talking. And it's going to be a bit of a problem, you see, because I'm kind of one of these unpredictable sort of creative kind of wild Macintosh kind of guys. And so it's going to be... So we're just going to have to see how it goes. I'm going to try and keep to the right time. One of the problems with my speeches is that they tend to be rather digressive, and it's only right at the very, very end that I try and wrap it all up, and you get some idea about what it was I was actually talking about. So I may or may not get to the end. If I don't get to the end, maybe we should have a little sort of contest on the internet. I'll give you my... email address, and you can send me little notes about what you think it was I was talking about and what you thought I was going to say at the end. And there will be a very, 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 very tiny little prize for whoever gets it right. Well, of course, I might finish early, in which case we shall have to have some questions. First of all, I need to pace around a little bit. I've got a bit of jet lag, and it's one of those days when you sort of wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning. But I also like to tend to wander around a great deal when I'm talking anyway. There's a friend of mine who was at Trinity College Dublin a few years ago, and he was studying psychology. And he was going to a regular series of lectures given by a guy who was lecturing on Pavlov and the conditioned response. And this guy was a great pacer. He walked up and down in front of the class, left and right, left and right. And after a while, all the members of the class conspired together so that every time he got to the left-hand end of his perambulation, they all looked bright and alert and intelligent and asked bright, intelligent questions. And every time he got to the right-hand end of his walk, they all fell asleep. So by the end of the course, they'd got him permanently holed up on the left-hand end. They'd put him on a kind of virtual slope. I don't know, history doesn't relate what happened to all those students, but I feel they should have just got a first in that paper. When virtual worlds and real worlds collide, you can have some alarming things happening. I was told a story the other day about some fighter planes that apparently were designed entirely, I think it was the F-16, but I could be wrong, I'm not an expert in fighter planes. It was designed entirely in the computer, tested in the computer, flight tested, everything was done in the computer to begin with, and eventually they were built, and the machine worked perfectly. It was a wonderful, wonderful aircraft. And then one day, a flight of four of them were out on the Pacific going through some maneuvers, and they were all flying in line, and suddenly the one right in front, for no reason at all, flipped over. And the one a couple of minutes behind him, or just a few seconds behind him, thought, what's going on? What's happened to this guy? And a moment later, he flipped over. So the guy behind them says, what's happening? These guys are going crazy. Why is everybody flipping over? And a moment later, his plane flipped over. All four flipped over. And it turned out they'd just done, in the real world, something that they'd never done in the virtual world in this plane, which was fly over the equator. And in the navigation systems, there was a sign error. One of the things that the virtual world and the real world has in common is that there is an awful lot of data out there. There is an enormous amount of data out there. How do we make sense of it? Well, largely by ignoring most of it and making a model for ourselves out of the rest. We do ignore an awful lot of it. We have to, because this is so much. There's a story I was told the other day about a dolphin research establishment, and they just got a new dolphin that was just joining the establishment, so they were running a few tests to see if they'd got a good dolphin, a bright, intelligent dolphin. They tried a few little simple little learning tests. They encouraged it to jump out of the water, make a noise, and if it made the noise, it got a fish. Very, very simple, very straightforward. The dolphin got it straight away. But they carried on the test just to sort of see if it could keep on doing it, and suddenly the dolphin began to seem to sort of drift from its purpose, drift from what it was being told to do. And every time it jumped out, it didn't necessarily make the noise that it had been asked to make. And it would make a different kind of noise, or make a quieter noise, or a louder noise, or a deeper noise. And then it was, and so they're getting a little bit crazy, because sometimes it wouldn't even make a noise at all. So it would jump out of the water, not make a noise, and not get a fish. So thinking, this is a stupid dolphin. What is going on? We thought it was meant to be an intelligent creature. So anyway, they abandoned the experiments. A little bit later in that evening, one of them was playing a tape they'd made and playing it through an oscilloscope and suddenly noticed what was happening, which was that, in fact, the dolphin was making a noise every single time it jumped out of the pool, but sometimes it lay above or below our hearing range. And the notes were going up and they were going down, they were getting louder and they're getting quieter, and he suddenly realized what was happening. We thought that we were training the dolphin to jump out of the water, make a noise and get a fish, but what the dolphin was doing was calibrating our hearing range. There's more data out there than we respond to. It's another experiment I was told about recently. I think I read about it in New Scientist. A subject was put in front of a computer screen, and there were two images for the computer screen, the speech, the text of to be or not to be, the speech from Hamlet, and the other was just a page of complete gibberish, meaningless twaddle and gibberish. It was I don't know what it was. It was probably a page of the user manual from Word 6. but both images were stored in the memory for the screen, and what was shown there most of the time was the page of complete gibberish. But stored, as I say, in a buffer behind it was the text of to be or not to be. The subject was put in front of a computer screen and had this kind of helmet on, which had sensors trained on the eyeballs. Now, you may or may not know that when the eyeball moves, it doesn't move smoothly. It moves in tiny little jumps from one point to another. And the jumps can be measured ballistically. If you know, if you have a sufficiently accurate measuring equipment, then you can see from the speed and direction with which the eyeball sets off on one of its little jumps where it's going to. So, what happened in this experiment was that as the sensor detected where the eyeball was going to, it substituted just at that one little spot on the screen the appropriate word from to be or not to be. So from the point of view of anybody else looking at the screen, it seemed to be full of gibberish, but from the point of view of the person who was wearing the device, all they ever saw was the text of to be or not to be. And not only was that all they ever saw, but they had no idea that there was anything else on the screen to see. Now what that shows us is that not only do we take a small amount of data from the world and create a model, but the model is persistent. The model actually exists in our head, and we just take tiny little bits of data and update the model that we keep in our head. As you probably know, we have rather odd feature to our eye. Well, I guess it's not a feature, it's a bug, which is that the optic nerve comes in right at the back of the eyeball, and where it comes in, there are no light-sensitive rods. So whatever light falls on that tiny little patch of the eyeball, or the back of the eyeball, will not respond. So we have a tiny little spot in each eye that does not respond to light. Now, if you close one eye or the other, you are not aware of seeing a black spot anywhere. But if you train yourself, you can actually find it. There are little tricks you can do whereby you sort of move your eye along a line, and you've got a little thing, a pea or something, just at the point where and you're trying to maneuver your blind spot over the pea, and the pea suddenly just winks out of existence. You don't see a black hole; you just no longer see the pea anymore. The reason we don't see a black hole is, why would our brain tell us there's a black hole there? We just have a model in our mind. Charles II actually used to have an interesting little trick with this. And it was, if you were a member of Charles II's court, you always knew you were in trouble if you found that he was looking at you like this. Because it meant he was trying to see what you looked like without your head on. So we keep a model of the world in our head, and we use the incoming data just to update it. Now let me tell you a little story about something that happened to me a while ago. One or two of you, if you've ever heard me speak before, might have heard me tell this story before, but I'm quite keen to keep on telling it because this is a story that's kind of acquired the status of an urban myth. But you know what the thing about urban myths are? That they're always assumed never actually to have happened. You always hear people saying, this happened to my wife's brother's sister's first cousin. But in this case, it isn't a myth, because it did actually happen to somebody, and the person to whom it happened was, in fact, me. A few years ago, I was on I was catching a train from Cambridge to London. And I arrived at the train station a little early. I was about 20 minutes early. I'd got the time of the train wrong. Well, actually, what is more likely is that British Rail had got the time of the train wrong, but never mind. And I went and got myself a newspaper. I was going to do the crossword. And I went to the buffet, and I got myself a cup of coffee and a packet of biscuits. Oh, excuse me, I have to say cookies on this side of the Atlantic. But if you just sort of put a little sort of search and replace thing in your brain, if you hear me say biscuits, just think cookies, okay? So I went and sat at a table in the buffet. I want you to picture the scene. Here was I sitting at a table, and here is a newspaper, cup of coffee, packet of biscuits, cookies. And there's a guy sitting opposite me. Perfectly ordinary looking guy, sitting there in a business suit, briefcase. Didn't look as if he was about to do anything weird. What he did was this. He leant across the table, picked out the packet of biscuits, tore it open, took one out, and ate it. Now, this is the sort of thing I have to tell you that the British are very bad at coping with. There is nothing in our entire culture or upbringing that trains you to deal with someone who steals one of your biscuits. Now, you know what would happen if this was New York. Somebody would end up dead pretty quickly. But in the end, I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do under the circumstances, and I ignored it. And stared at the newspaper, tried to do one of the clues in the crossword, couldn't. Took a sip of coffee, took a deep breath and thought, well, I'd better just go for one of my biscuits. And I leant across and I took one, trying hard not to notice that it was somehow mysteriously open. And a moment or two passed, and he did it again. He took another biscuit. And having not said anything the first time, it was somehow even more difficult to sort of raise the matter the second time. Excuse me, I couldn't help but notice. I mean, he said, it doesn't work. So again, I ignored it and I leant across and I took another one. And our eyes met just for a moment. And then we both looked away. But there's a little tension building up over the table at this point. And between us, we got through the whole packet of biscuits this way. He took one, I took one, he took one. And I say whole packet, when there are only about six, I think, or six or eight. But it seemed like a lifetime of cookies we were getting through at this point. So eventually, we get to the end of the packet. He stands up and goes away. And I sit back and breathe a sigh of relief. A few minutes later, my trainer's called. So I toss back the last of my coffee, stand up, pick up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper are my biscuits. The nice thing, I guess, about that story is somewhere in England there is this guy who's probably been wandering around the country for years telling this exact same story, but he hasn't got the punchline. But the point of this story is that sometimes you're using the incoming data to update a model that is intrinsically faulty. Archaeology, I'm told, is like that. It's funny, there are all sorts of sciences, archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, which started out as the domain of gentlemen enthusiasts in the 19th century. Schliemann, who went to Troy, Arthur Evans, who went to Knossos, and they took with them in their minds, they already had ideas of what they wanted to find. Arthur Evans going to Knossos particularly had this image of a wonderful, brilliant, enlightened, pre-Greek Minoan culture, and every piece of data that he found, he basically bent to fit into that model. There's a wonderful book I came across recently, I don't know if it's still in print, called The Secret of Crete by a German geologist called Hans Wunderlich. And he was an amateur archaeologist. He'd read a lot of the debates that went on and on about what had happened to Knossos, what had brought about its downfall, was it destroyed by fire when the volcano at Santorini went up. So one of the issues was it destroyed by fire? And as I say, early archaeologists really weren't scientists at all. They just went in with a nice idea and found whatever data fitted the idea they already had. When Hans Wunderlich arrived there, just as a tourist, he just bought his ticket and he walked in, and he noticed immediately, just as a geologist, as a scientist, that it could not possibly have been destroyed by fire, because the stonework that was used for the walls and the floors, which had been described hitherto as being alabaster, was in fact no such thing. And you could tell that it wasn't alabaster, but actually a form of gypsum that has a particular kind of mineral deposit veined into it, which gives it the same lustrous sheen as alabaster, but is much, much softer and much easier to work than alabaster. So if you don't want that hardness and firmness of alabaster, then you'll go for this gypsum instead. And the way you tell the difference is you run your fingernail along it. And if you scratch it, it's gypsum. If you don't, it's alabaster. But the thing about this particular type of alabaster, this particular kind of gypsum, is if it gets raised above a certain temperature, all the mineral deposits that give it its sheen will leach out of it. And that hadn't happened. So ipso facto, clearly it wasn't destroyed by fire. He then thought, well, it's very funny that it's been made of this very soft material, including the floors, because the floors have obviously now been very badly worn away. But when the excavation was started at the beginning of the century, I think it was in 1913, the floors weren't worn away. So this is a busy, bustling city where the floors had been made of soft gypsum and they weren't worn away at all until modern times. That didn't seem to make sense. And he eventually went back to all the original data and came up with a completely new picture of what Knossos was. I won't go through all the rest of the detail, but it's absolutely fascinating, because the theory he comes up with is that Knossos was not a city, it was a necropolis, a city of the dead, which is why people didn't walk around in it very much. And what was very interesting to me about this particular book, I mean, I can't tell you whether it's true or not, I'm not an archaeologist, but simply as an exercise in going back to the data and deriving a more logical model from it, it was absolutely fascinating. So we all select different data from the world out there to create our models. I once went looking for rhinoceroses. Which is it? Rhinoceri. Well, it doesn't matter. It was only one. It was a rhinoceros. And there was a small bunch of us, there were five of us, going to try and get close to this rhinoceros. It was a northern white rhinoceros in Zaire. We discovered a very interesting thing, which is that you can get quite close to it if you play Grandmother's Footsteps. I don't know if that name means anything over here in England. It's the name we give to the children's game, where you creep closer and closer to somebody who's got their back turned to you or towards you, and if they turn around and catch you moving, you're out, you're dead. But if you freeze at that moment, then you're okay. So the rhinoceros was sort of chewing around on the grass, and we were able to creep closer and closer. And every time a movement would attract its attention, you'd stop and freeze, whereupon it couldn't see you anymore. And it would think, oh, obviously nothing's there, so it'd carry on eating. It was only when the wind changed direction and suddenly we were upwind of it rather than downwind that it suddenly knows all about us and makes off. Makes its escape. I always thought it was us who meant to make our escape, but there you go. And the point is, as I discovered, that rhinoceroses use sight the way we use smell, and smell the way we use sight. We tend to use smell as a kind of, just an indication that something may be wrong. Ever since we stood up and lifted our nose off the ground, and our noses are now, well, mine is about 6 feet off the ground, and you can't really smell very much from up here, so our sense of smell is kind of decayed. So we tend to use it just to tell us something's gone wrong, if there's a gas leak or whatever. But then, if you really want to know what's up, you go and find what's happening by looking at it. The rhinoceros is the other way around. It uses sight just as a sort of general alarm signal, and smell as a way of modeling the world. Now, that is an utterly, utterly extraordinary idea. I talked about dolphins earlier. Dolphins use sound very often to model their world. And there's a very interesting difference between sound and light when you consider we use light to model the world, i.e. the model, what we see comes to us in the form of light, which as we know, travels at 186,000 miles per second, which, to all intents and purposes, instantaneously, which means that the order in which things present themselves to our senses is actually the same order in which they've happened out there. In the case of a dolphin, that's not quite true, because sound only travels at 1,100 feet per second. But in the case of a rhinoceros, something really weird is happening, because it is able to respond to all kind of fantastic level of sensitivity to all the smells around it, and it can detect what smells have been around for the last 2 minutes, the last couple of hours, the last day. It can tell if another rhinoceros was here yesterday, how it moved around, what kind of mood the other rhinoceros was in. Was it being attacked by something? Was it on heat? Was it hungry? Was it frightened? All these kinds of things. It's there in the air around it. So if you think that it has a model in its mind of the world around it, and the incoming data is updating that model, what kind of world is it looking at? It must be looking at a world in which you see time as a landscape. Now, that's very, very odd for us to try and consider, because the only world we've ever had any experience of is the virtual world in which we human beings live, because we're all human beings. And the only people we've ever spoken to about it are other human beings who share the same idea. So if my slightly fanciful idea that maybe rhinoceroses live in a completely different relationship to time than we do, we wouldn't know. Evolution has determined what type of data we use to create the models that we use from. In the case of, for instance, dolphin, there's a dolphin I once went to try and find, which is the Baiji dolphin, the Yangtze River dolphin, which is an almost blind dolphin. The reason it's almost blind is that there's nothing to see in the Yangtze River. Thousands of years of agriculture along the banks of the Yangtze have washed so much silt into it that gradually it could see less and less, and so its eyes gradually atrophied, while its ability to model the world in sound got more and more sensitive and powerful and strong. And so it was able to, enabled to make that adaptation. It now faces a problem because we've now invented the diesel engine, which means that the Yangtze River is now full of noise. But there are other kinds of animals, like bats, for instance, that work on sound, because they're nocturnal, so light isn't going to work for them, so they model stuff in sound. So there are all kinds of different ways in which evolution tends to lead one animal or another to model the world in different kinds of ways. Now, I have a rather serious announcement to make. You may want to brace yourself for this. Human evolution is at an end. It is finished. It's official. The point at which it finished was the point at which we first started to learn to use tools. I'll give you an example of how it works. The sort of thing that drives evolutionary change is this. When some small group of a particular population of animals gets separated off from the main body and finds itself in some new environment. Maybe there's been some geological upheaval, maybe it's pressure of population, shortage of food, forces some small group to go off to a new environment. And let's say, in this case, a small body of animals has gone off to a new environment where it's much colder, or just a little bit colder. Come back in a few generations, and those genes that favor thicker coats will have come to the fore, and you'll find that the animal has developed, over a few generations, much thicker coats. Now, human beings go about this in a different way. Now, we have learned to live in all parts of the world. We can live in the Sahara, we can live in the tundra, we can live in We can live in the Gobi Desert. We can even live in New York, for God's sake. We can live anywhere. Because what happens is if we move somewhere where, say, it's a little bit colder, and remember we're tool users, we move somewhere a little bit colder, we don't wait for generations to go by while nature brings forward those genes that give us a thicker coat. We see an animal that's got a thicker coat, we say, we'll have it off him. So we can continually protect ourselves from evolutionary change. So now, we live in a world in which if you're sick or injured, you don't die. If the harvest fails, you don't die. If it's suddenly very, very cold, you don't die. If you're rather sort of slow-witted, you don't die. If you're thoroughly stupid, you get elected to high office. And what has happened instead, as a kind of substitute for any physical evolution, because we've kind of taken charge of what happens to us, we've created this buffer zone between ourselves and our environment, so that the abrasion that the environment usually forces on an entity doesn't happen. So instead, we have this culture we've created, and that first thing, that first use of tools and tool use came from the ability to put things together in our head, to model stuff in our head, to put concepts together, to see some little thing that you learnt about the action of a sharp stone that you learnt in one context, and the effect of a sharp stone in another context, and you learn to sharpen a stone and take it somewhere else, and you do that by putting these things together in your head, and then being able to create tools that will create more tools, and use these to change our world. So it's that ability to model stuff in software, in our heads, that has led to us creating this enormously complex culture which we live within, and which is the medium of our communication and is our protection from the environment. Now, it was that tool use, that ability to model stuff in software, that led to the explosive rise of human culture. Curious parallel to that is what happened to the personal computer. Because personal computers were around for a few years, used by hobbyists and kids and anoraks. We were encouraged to think they'd be very useful things for storing our recipes in. The thing that led to the explosive takeoff of computers was a program called VisiCalc, designed by Dan Bricklin. The point about VisiCalc was it enabled us to model in software something. We were unable to model something in software before we tried it out in the real world. You were able to take a whole business plan, a whole financial strategy, try tweaking a percentage point here, try taking a cent off there. How does that sweep through the whole picture? And we were able to do detailed models in software before we tried it out in the real world, and that was the moment at which the computer itself became an enormously useful tool. And that was what led to the explosive takeoff of the personal computer. Now, for a long time, we weren't really very clear about what computers were. I certainly wasn't. I remember the first time I ever saw a computer, a personal computer. It was a Commodore PET. It's kind of a little sort of pyramid kind of thing, sort of huge, great sort of body with a tiny little screen. And it was sitting in a hardware store in London, England. And I went in and had a look at it and thought, well, this is a kind of great kind of thing. This is a kind of wonderful sort of thing. And I was sort of fascinated by it, but I just couldn't think. I couldn't imagine what possible purpose it could serve for me because I was a writer. What use could a computer possibly be to a writer. And I puzzled about this. I have to say that I did, nevertheless, despite the fact that I couldn't see any possible use for it, I did suffer the first tiniest pangs, the first sort of inklings of something that subsequently was going to give a whole new meaning to the phrase disposable income. But the reason that I didn't understand why it could possibly be any use to me was I had the wrong idea of what it was. I thought it was an adding machine. And this is what everybody thought it was. Everybody thought it was a kind of super adding machine and developed it as an adding machine. And after a while, we get so adept at adding up numbers and manipulating numbers that you begin to think, well, we can make these numbers stand for something else. And we make the numbers stand for, let's say, the letters of the alphabet. And we invent ASCII code. And suddenly we say, God, we were so stupid. We were so short-sighted. Why do we think it was just an adding machine? It isn't an adding machine. It's much more wonderful than that. It's a typewriter. And we develop it as a typewriter with a long feature list. Then we look at it again, and our number crunching ability has got a little faster and a little more sophisticated. So we say, okay, let's make each number stand for the elements of a graphic display, for pixels. And we suddenly realize, oh God, we were so short-sighted to think it was just an adding machine or a typewriter. It's a television with a typewriter in front of it. We've now gone to another iteration with the World Wide Web. Because we're now saying, it isn't any of those things, it isn't just a stupid television, it's a brochure. So we are developing it as a bunch of a million brochures. The point to bear in mind is that it isn't any of these things. It isn't an adding machine. It isn't a typewriter. It isn't a television. It certainly isn't a bunch of brochures. But it is significant that each of these things which we previously knew about and knew how to use and knew how to work, adding machines, typewriters, televisions, brochures, we modeled in the computer. Because the computer isn't any of these things, but the fact that we are able to model those things in it tells us what the computer is. It's a modeling device. And it's only when we begin to understand that that we're going to be able to start really doing useful things with it. We have to abandon our old models in order to be able to think of the thing as a modeling device itself. Now, I often speak, I mean, over the last few years, I've spoken from time to time at publishing events or television events or journalism events, and there was a whole phase when people would come up to me and say afterwards, yeah, I hear you know something about computers, and I say, well, yeah, a little bit. And they say, well, we're terribly, terribly interested and a little bit worried. So what exactly is the effect of computers going to be on the publishing business, or what is the effect of computers going to be on the television business? And largely they were hoping for the answer, not very much. But the issue was this, that if you have to ask the question, then you're not ready for the answer. Because it's rather like the Mississippi River or the Amazon or the Nile saying, well, what effect is the coming of the Atlantic Ocean going to have on me? And the answer is that river rules will no longer apply. And you'll be able to tell the people who are out there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean trying to build riverbanks around themselves, because they'll be the people who are going out of business. Because we have to think in terms of new models. We have to understand what it means when every form of data we have, every type of medium we have, every type of information, every type of experience we might have can be expressed in the same language and is out there in this digital ocean. We select from that ocean of data, and we model the data we choose in ways that make sense to us, in the same way that a dolphin does, or a rhinoceros does, or we do. But human beings now have this extension of our ability to model things. We have an extension to our mind, if you like, the extension to that important part of our mind, the ability to model things, the ability to model things in software. Most animals have an extension to their neck or their running muscles. We have an extension to our brain, an extension to our ability to think and to model. How are we going to make these two things work together? How are we going to make the modeling device we have in our brain and the modeling device we have in these computers work together in a way that makes sense? How can they enhance each other? Well, there are good ways and there are bad ways. So a very interesting, very bad way. Years ago, when I first visited the Media Lab, it was actually the Architectural Machine Group then, it wasn't even the Media Lab. And when I give you this example, I don't in any way wish to denigrate the work of the Media Lab. I mean, because it's actually making silly mistakes that you learn an awful lot from. Now, this particular experiment, if you like, was designed to try and deal with this problem. It was assumed that we would never ever have enough bandwidth to give us working video phones, that we were going to be restricted to the amount of bandwidth we currently get over copper, which just gives us analog sound that's not terribly high quality. So they're trying to figure out, is there a way in which we can sort of simulate simulate the working of a video phone using this relatively narrow bandwidth? And one bright spark had come up with this idea, which is an awful lot of the people you speak to on the phone, you speak to quite regularly. So why don't you have stored at your end a picture of the people who call you? Well, you'll have a picture of your wife, a picture of your mother and your brother and your best friend and your boss and so on. And whenever any of them call you, the phone will know, we'll be able to tell the number it's coming from, and will flash up the picture of the person on your screen. And the incoming sound, the incoming phonemes coming in over the line, will waggle their mouth. Now you can imagine how completely absurd this looked. It was just completely ridiculous. It was like something out of Python. But hello, my dog's died. You know, it's sort of. But it wasn't merely completely ridiculous. It was actually self-defeating in a kind of rather ingenious way. Let me see if I explain. Now, when we talk to somebody, if I'm standing talking to somebody directly, then we are reading an awful lot of information off each other. It's not just what I'm saying. It isn't the grammatical, semantic content of what I'm saying. It's the whole tone of voice. It's the whole way I gesture. And I know I gesture an awful lot. When I was young, my mother, if she wanted me to shut up, made me sit on my hands. The whole way our face moves. We're communicating in virtually everything we do as we speak to somebody. If you start to compress that bandwidth. Suppose you can't see the person, but you can hear them. You can get an awful lot. We are so fantastically adept at understanding, at communicating with understanding what other people say to us and what they mean, and deriving all kinds of information from what they say, that even if we can't see them, we will actually fill that missing part of the bandwidth with information that we derive from just what we can hear. And if you squash the bandwidth more and more and more and more and more till you get down to telephone quality, then because the degradation of the sound signal has been done, if you like, gracefully, we are still able, with the processing power we have, to decompress that very, very narrow bandwidth of information to fill most of the rest of the missing bandwidth. We can fill it up. Unless the computer, in this instance, has gone in there and filled it up already with junk. So it's important to understand what we are good at and what the computer is good at, and make sure we don't mismatch the things. This was a very, very bad mismatch. Now here's a more interesting, good way of using the computer's ability to model and our ability to model to enhance each other. This is an experiment I read about in something called haptic virtual reality. Haptic virtual reality is one which is not merely immersive and stereoscopic vis-a-vis light, sight. It also has some sort of tactile feedback. This can be provided, and it was in this particular instance, by a lever that you can move with your hand. And because our hands are fantastically delicate and sensitive to movement and to pressure, it can be a very, very delicate and powerful way of controlling and guiding something. So in this particular instance, what was being modeled was a problem. And the problem was a rather complicated one. It was a road has got to be built through some rolling hills, and there are certain constraints on this road. One is, as you're driving it across the hills, you want to keep the road as flat as possible so that there aren't a lot of up and down gradients, but you also want to make it as straight as possible so there aren't a lot of bends. Now, those are obviously two opposing constraints. If you add to it another constraint, which is there are a lot of houses along the way in these hills, and any house you knock down in order to build your road, you've got to buy. So there's a major expense issue here, a major expense factor in how you determine the track your road is going to take through these hills that are first of all rolling hills and covered with houses. And the answer is that you build all kinds of resistances into the lever, which is effectively a 3D stylus that you're going to try and draw the route of this road through the hills with. And you have a resistance going side to side because the road mustn't waggle too much. You have a certain amount of inbuilt resistance going up and down because you don't want the road to go up and down too much. And you also have a certain resistance that way depending on how many houses you're going through. So there's suddenly an awful lot of information coming in through this handle. Now, you try and find some other way of solving this problem, sitting down and doing the numbers. It's enormously complicated because you've got so many conflicting, interlocking variables. On the other hand, you give it to your hand to deal with, and your hand is very expert at resolving all kinds of different variables because we have such enormously intricate nerves and muscles. And very quickly, the subject was able to find a quick and easy and inexpensive route through these hills just by maneuvering the lever through it. So that is a way in which we can take a different set of data from the world out there, do something intelligent in the machine with it, and present it to this modeling device in a way that it can make a new kind of sense out of. Let's think about, we're here to talk about building applications from the internet, and I've got 14 minutes left, so I might have a little word about that. I came across a thing the other day, I was rather shocked by it, which was the information that most people, even intelligent, educated people, don't know what causes the seasons. Why do we have spring, summer, autumn, and winter? Most people, when asked if they have any kind of intelligent answer at all, will say, isn't it something to do with the fact of being, you know, the Earth's orbit is an ellipse, and maybe it's winter when we're further away from the sun, and summer when we're closer to the sun. Now, a couple of seconds thought will tell you that isn't the case, because when it's summer in England, it's winter in Australia, and vice versa. And in fact, the Earth's orbit is at the moment very, very close to being circular. At other points in its history, it will be more elliptical, but because of the differential speed with which the Earth goes round different parts of the ellipse, the amount of heat being soaked up by the Earth from the sun at any point is actually a constant. So the thing is that it isn't anything to do with the orbit, the shape of the orbit of the Earth around the sun. And it's very, very simple. It has to do with the fact that the Earth spins at a slight angle. It's not completely upright. And so as it goes around the sun, different parts of the world are tilted directly towards the sun at different times of the year. And when you're tilted towards the sun, you're going to have summer, and when you're tilted away from the sun, you're going to have winter, and spring and autumn will obviously, spring and fall will obviously fall in between. So here is a single, simple piece of information that people ought to have. People ought to know that. What can you do with that piece of information if you felt, well, people ought to know it? Well, one of the things you could do is you could put it on the web. You could type up the description I've just given you and put it on your homepage and invite people who want to know what causes the seasons to visit your homepage and read what you've written, and lo and behold, they will then know. Well, I suppose that's quite a good idea. It's using the computer as a typewriter. But supposing we say, well, actually, you can do something a little bit more elaborate than that. You can get an animation program like Director, and you can create a little animation of the Earth going around the sun that'll clearly demonstrate the fact that the tilt causes the seasons. And that's a little bit better than what we had before, because you can actually see it happening. But that's using the computer as a television. What might be more interesting is say, well, why don't we create an actual model of the way the Earth goes around the sun, so that when people want that piece of information, they will actually have something that actually is a working model of the thing itself. And while you're doing it, why don't you create a working model of the whole solar system? And if you create it in such a way that anybody else who's then got a piece of information, say, about the trajectory of a satellite or the trajectory of the Galileo or the Voyager or Mariner probes, you can actually put that into the model. And you can fill up this model with more and more and more information about the way the whole solar system works. And anybody then who wants to find out anything about this doesn't have to read something that you've typed or watch something that you made a little animation of, but can go to the actual model itself and derive whatever piece of information they may be looking for from it. Because the model that you create and that anybody out there can actually add to will in the end yield more information than you actually put into it. So if we start to embark on those kinds of exercises, then we are no longer using the computer as a typewriter or a television. We're actually using it as a modeling device, which is what it actually is. The first moment, I guess, it became apparent to me that there was something new and strange happening out in the World Wide Web. The first moment at which I knew something was up, that we weren't in Kansas anymore, that the world was shaking beneath our feet, was something profoundly silly. There was, it turns out, a guy who was working in a university lab, and he was a computer student, computer science student, and he used to, every now and then, go and get himself a Coca-Cola from a machine that was a few hundred yards down the corridor. Sometimes he'd arrive there and find that it was empty, and he'd wasted his journey. So he got a bit fed up with that, and being a hacker, he decided, okay, well, I'm going to put a network connection to the Coke machine so that I can tell from my desk if there's any Coca-Cola in the machine before I have to walk down the corridor. And, of course, one of the effects of putting something on the net is that not only can you read that device from a couple of hundred yards down the corridor, you can read it from the other side of the world as well. And gradually, more and more Coca-Cola machines started to appear on the net. And you could log on to a Coca-Cola machine from anywhere you were in the world you liked, and discover how many Diet Cokes there were, how many Dr. Peppers there were, how many Fantas there were, when last somebody had taken one of what, when they were last loaded up, what temperature they were. I mean, it was an enormous wealth of completely meaningless information. But the great thing, the great and completely and utterly frivolous, meaningless thing, was that if somebody had gone to that machine and had put 50 cents in the slot and hadn't pressed the button, and you came across a machine in that pregnant state from anywhere in the world, from 10,000 miles away, you could drop that can. And somebody would be walking along the corridor and walking past this Coca-Cola machine, and suddenly, out of nowhere, like a Coca-Cola can would drop out of the machine. Now, I don't know what the person would think. They probably wouldn't have thought it was somebody sending a code from 10,000 miles away that did that. Now, this is not, in the scale of things, an enormously useful thing. It is not a great boon to human civilization, the ability to drop a Coca-Cola tin from 10,000 miles away. But it does indicate something tremendously interesting that has happened. It kind of completes the last side of a square that's been missing in this century. Now let's go back to an earlier form of life, an earlier form of civilization, an earlier form of culture, when we lived essentially local lives, when our lives were bounded by the horizon. Now we would have various kinds of communication with our world. We would talk to each other. I would stand up and talk to somebody else, and they'd talk back to me. One-to-one communication. You'd also have singers and poets who would entertain an audience, or the leader of the village would get up and sort of say, here's something we ought to do, and here's a proclamation, and here's a new law, or whatever it is. I.e., one-to-many communications. You'd also have petitions. If everybody feels very strongly about something, they all sort of sign a little piece of paper and send it along to the leader of the village and say, "Oi, this is what we all think. What are you going to do about it?" So that is many-to-one communications. And then we also have the town meeting. Many-to-many communications. Now, in this century, we have found electronic models for all our different types of communication. One-to-one communication, the telephone. You can phone each other up and talk to each other. One-to-many communications. Well, we're flooded with it. Absolutely flooded with it. Radio, television, newspapers, every kind of mass media that exists is one-to-many communications. And it's one of the reasons we lead such extraordinary sort of fractured, crazy lives, because we get information coming at us when we're used to working and inhabiting a completely local world. We're getting information coming at us from all over the world. There's been an air crash here. There's been there's a little girl lost down a well there. All this information that we get terribly worked up about, even though it's thousands of miles away or hundreds of miles away, and however much you react to it, the world doesn't react back to your reaction. It is purely one-to-many communications. And it becomes very, very oppressive. We also now have the ability to do petitions, obviously, on a national basis. So that's many-to-one communications. But never until the web arrived, until the internet's infrastructure arrived, did we have the ability to respond back to the world. When the world sends us all sorts of stimulus, previously, however we responded, the world didn't take any account of our response. That last element was missing, the many-to-many communication. The fact that we can reach out in the world and contact, touch, communicate with other people, which is signaled by the fact that you can just quite trivially and pointlessly and frivolously reach out and drop a Coca-Cola can 10,000 miles away. That is what signifies that that last corner, that last square, that last side of the square has been put in place. And suddenly our means of communication with each other in the virtual world now matches, is now parallel to our means of communication with each other in the real world. And that, I think, is a very significant moment. A little while ago, I was trying to find out, as a matter of interest, what a biologist's definition of life is. It's kind of it's actually quite tricky to try and work out. And we all instinctively know what's alive and what isn't. But trying to define it is actually oddly tricky. I mean, any set of objects that's going to include both Bill Gates and the Great Barrier Reef is going to be hard to define with any sort of great precision. However, there are certain things that you can say that something lifelike will exhibit. Certainly complexity, the ability to organize information within itself, the ability to respond to information, the ability to communicate. All these things are the things that we would think of as being lifelike qualities. Now, the computer itself is not really a very good example of something that exhibits lifelike qualities. But when you consider what is happening in this buffer zone we've created around ourselves, that started with the animal skins we put around ourselves and then went to the bricks and the mortar and then gradually the more and more, all of the enormous complexities of modern life that we have surrounded ourselves, the buffer zone that separates ourselves from our environment. And when you consider that this buffer zone is now something that we are wiring up with enormous complexity by putting all the devices that we use to model our world into communication with each other, so these enormously tangled networks are spreading out through this buffer zone, and the information that is moving through those networks, and this is the most extraordinary facet of the net, as the information moves through the net, part of what's going through it are new pieces of software that will increase the level of complexity and organization in the net. And you'll find messages going backwards and forwards between ourselves, between each other, between the different computers, between the outside world and ourselves, between our environment and ourselves. And gradually, this buffer zone we've connected around ourselves is becoming less and less like the brick walls of a house keeping out the cold, and more like a virtual epidermis which is responding to it. So, the message that I would like to try and put across to people as we develop the stuff that's going to go into this wired up buffer zone that is gradually beginning to form, if you like, the next stage of our evolution, is don't build dead things in it. Don't build dead pages. Build living models. Thank you very much.